What I really enjoy from a creative standpoint is to take something that's already being done and reposition it, you know, and put an edge on it where a person that may be in that lane can't see any bigger than that, or can't see that the destination can go further than the stoplight ahead of you.
Between the Grooves is hosted by James Curtis, music director and morning man in the Greater Toronto Area on Joy Radio, and Aisha Woods, Grammy-nominated singer, songwriter, and musician. Together, they talk with artists and industry insiders to discover our connection between music and faith. You can connect with us on Facebook or Twitter at Between Grooves. Now, here's James and Aisha.
Do you like fruit?
In general, yes. Like any particular type of fruit?
Yeah. Do you have a favorite fruit?
Depends. Like it's if it's fresh, apple, yeah, it's okay.
That is my favorite
really?
Fruit. Yes.
For me, it depends on how ripe it is. You know, like a banana as an example. You know, you give me I like banana, but don't give it to me green. And don't give it to me overripe.
Right.
Strawberries,
right.
Like them fresh when it's strawberry season. Otherwise, I don't like them because they're just not as sweet and juicy as they would normally be.
No, they're not.
And blueberries and everything else. Right? So it's got to be like the seasonal fruit. Then I'm really good with it.
Right.
How did we ever get talking about fruits and vegetables?
I have no idea, but that's all right. It makes me think of, I got to start being all spiritual, right?
Yeah. this is a Christian podcast, so yeah, you're on in 3, 2, there you go.
It makes me think of the scripture that talks about not putting all of your eggs in one basket and not knowing where you may find success.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to find it somewhere. It's in the word somewhere, but it just makes me think of Terrence and our conversation with Terrence, him being an entrepreneur and having his hands in many different things and finding success at it, mm-hmm. you know?
I think it's really difficult for artists and musicians if they're really passionate about music and they don't necessarily have the business skills. I think it's really mm-hmm. difficult for an artist or a musician to succeed. Because they spend all their time doing the music side of things. They don't invest any time in the business side of things. And so sometimes it's just more of a hobby. And unless they can get people on board on their team to help with the stuff that they're not necessarily good at, right?
Sure.
But here's a guy that is, you know, has been brilliant on the keys and has, like you said, found success in what he has pursued and what he enjoys doing. And mm-hmm. I've always said, if you don't enjoy what you're doing, then why are you doing it?
Right, right.
Anyways, our guest, you've alluded to Terrence White. He is a VP, he's a producer at Red Worship, and he's a brilliant musician and a really interesting conversation I was not expecting with Terrence White from Red Worship. So let's get into this now.
Doing well, thanks for coming.
Good morning, Terrence.
Hey, great. Nice to meet you, James. Good morning. Thanks for you guys having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. I guess to start, you're somewhat musical, I guess, right?
Just a hint. I guess that would
just
be
a what
yeah, just a little bit.
I took piano lessons when I was a kid, and I took piano lessons because I was forced to. And so, you know, growing up in school, I really didn't care for the piano as much. I could still, you know, I know where middle C is, and that's a big step for anybody who doesn't know how to play the piano, right? And I know how to play chords, and I know the scales and everything else because I learned all that stuff. But for you, I guess you started playing the piano when you were young. Did you take lessons or did you learn by yourself?
Well, both. So actually, I'm what we call a PK, so I'm a pastor's kid.
I have
no music. Yeah, there's no musical influence anywhere in my bloodline. So I'm in my age difference between my siblings, there's a 10-year gap. So I was a child that wasn't really supposed to happen, but my dad begged
Surprise!
For my mom to conceive again. Yeah. And so, and once she found out she was pregnant, he laid hands on her belly and prayed that I would have some musical talent for whatever reason that
really?
Was. Yes. And so I think at 4 years old is when I discovered that I had it. I would just like look at TV shows and be enamored by like looking at Michael Jackson or the Hee Haws or whatever was live. It was a lot of live music at the time, even in gospel, Bobby Jones and things like that.
Sure.
And so my dad always had great music at his church and bands and guys that would come from nightclubs and, you know, get saved and go into church and play. So I just started like banging out on the piano, and my mom bought me a keyboard from a yard sale and just kind of tossed it in the room to see what I would do with it. And so I just started banging to make sense out of it until it, I was able to start playing songs that they were playing at church in my room. And so that was around the age of five to maybe seven. And at that point is when I started studying formally, but it didn't stick to me at the time formally because those elementary songs, I could grab them by ear pretty fast. And so,
sure.
You know, my musical instructor was trying to teach me how to read music. And if she played it one time, I'd have it by ear. So that was what the challenge was. And so she started, because she didn't play by ear, she started asking me how to play certain songs that she had to prepare for her service, like at church that she played at. And so it was like, hey, this is kind of a waste of my time in formal education. So I didn't pick formal education back up till I went to college. You know, I had a full ride at a HBCU, North Carolina Central University. And
all
that's
right.
Where I studied jazz and classical formally. And it was a bit of a challenge grabbing it formally at that age after having done it for years by ear. But I was able to meet the challenge, man. And so that's hopefully that's a long and short answer of that.
So when you consider music in your life now, are you a read from the notes or from the charts, or you're still the play by ear guy?
Little bit of both. Most of the applications in which that I'm playing in really require more ear. You know, after earning my degrees within the jazz thing, I did a lot of smooth jazz, even though I studied traditional jazz, big band swing, Chicago stuff. And it was like what was popular, you know, the difference between popular and absolute music, you know, what would really pay in that region, unless I wanted to go overseas, was music that was the smooth jazz era. So there's a guy named Marcus Anderson that I pretty much groomed and grew him into being an artist. He went on to play with Prince and now CeeLo Green and does a lot of festivals into a 16th album at this point. And we played the whole Raleigh-Durham circuit, you know, for me producing his records. And that was all emotionally based music. So some of the hybrid, if there's shows or things that I'm called on to be a music director, I may chart it out just to have a reference point. But most of the time it comes from emotion. You know, it's like, particularly if it's producing music, it's just what I feel in a moment that comes out. You know, getting this creative spark and you just start creating what it is that it's my, because it's a gift, it comes from God. And so,
yeah.
Reading is an extra step. Most of the time, if I'm hired as a session player and it's music that I don't have any clue with, which I haven't done that in a while because I'm producing my own stuff and helming up a record label, but it would normally start with charts that are handed to me. But, you know, by the end of reading the chart through, it's back to emotion again, you know, so I'm working both of those skill sets.
I would say that a chart is kind of a starting point.
Absolutely. Yes.
I had growing up in the church that I attended, we had this guy who played the Hammond organ. He was very skilled, very skilled musician, very skilled pianist. And this guy was just brilliant on the keyboard. And if you can just imagine the Hammond organ and you've got the chord charts, but he would stray from the chord charts and create these new notes that you've never heard of before. And so you would have even a traditional hymn that would sound completely different because of the weird, but there's a note there that I haven't heard before. And oh, that sounds really good.
And then
he would just go on and on with it. Like, to me, it sounds like that's what you enjoy the most.
Yeah, it's improvisation. It's one of which it's I'm using the word emotion, but it's one that I think being a musician or a creative in general, it should be one in which you're lending your gift back to the creator that gave it to you. And sure. So it's like moments that are in real time, particularly when in studying jazz, which is a very much improvisational piece of music. It's just like that. You know, you're not going to ever probably repeat the same thing. You know, I mean, outside of playing ahead of a song, the melody line, and it's one of which that God is just downloading in real time. A perfect creator that has a perfect timing will give you something in a moment that it's created that's just downloaded specifically to you. But hopefully it resonates right with the spirit and the soul of the individual who's a recipient of it. And sometimes we could get in our own way if we're not lended to that unique ability to do it. So that's probably what you're referring to. I don't use that as an excuse for discipline, because I am a disciplinary when it comes to music. So I do want to respect a composition and play it down according to how it was intended to be played. But I don't mind improvisation as well, you know, so it's a happy medium in the two worlds. I don't want it to be a jam session, but, you know, I do want what it is God is giving you to be able to be freely expressed. And hopefully in a collective of a band, if you've got the right synergy going, you can have those type of conversation happening in a band setting. You know, we'll look at each other and be like, man, we didn't even talk about this. And you played a note on the bass that complemented what I'm on. Playing on keyboard, and then there's another guy that's on drums that knows how to have the perfect accent at that time, or saxophonist, or what have you. So it's really a big conversation.
That's really neat. Now, how does that translate into your writing?
So my writing, and a lot of times what I've been doing lately within the Christian space, where I'm working with the label Red Worship, and it's a group. The group is actually called Red Worship. It's based in San Jose, California. And what we do is we have writing sessions. So this is a pretty popular thing that's happening now. It's called co-writes, and it's writing sessions. So we typically rent out homes, and we get together, and just it starts with us having conversations and really getting to know each other, and then maybe a topic. You know, because it's Christian music, obviously it's pointing back to God. But, you know, we may think about what's happening now in the world, or, you know, sonically, you know, with mainstream music, what's on trend, what's popular. And then it starts with somebody. I'm more than likely at the piano and I'm hatching out chords, or I'm great at doing top line melody. So I'll start doodling a melody, and a vocalist may say, what is that you're playing? And I'm like, I don't know. It's what God just gave me. And then lyrics start that melody line, you know, so that's for me, in any genre of music that I write, melody line is king to me. It's the most memorable thing. It's how we learn our ABCs. We've learned how to count. Anything is connected to a melody line. You know, people laugh at me because growing up, I learned the 50 states in alphabetical order, and it has to be attributed. And this was in kindergarten, to the way that they created a song, and just like the melody of that song is what forced me even to be able to this day retain all 50 states in alphabetical order.
That's awesome. I heard a comedian once say, half of you wouldn't know your ABCs if it wasn't a song. So, and I know that that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
We wouldn't know the order.
I would love to be that fly on the wall sitting there listening to one of your co-writes, just with my eyes closed, just listening, because it sounds like you talk about, you know, a co-write, and you're starting with this melody, but I'm thinking more like jam session, and then out of it comes this new song.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in certain settings, it can work itself that way. You know, say in this particular setting, and it doesn't feel as much as a jam session, because often I'm the only instrumentalist, unless it's a you know, we'll bring acoustic guitar. Sometimes I like to write from acoustic guitar well, to be a starting point. So we're not bringing a full band into these writes. It's mostly just lyricists and vocalists and a few instrumentalists. But, you know, other writes that I do, in Atlanta when I'm there, you know, it's, you know, in the R&B hip hop space, you know, it's a bunch of beat machines and I'm still probably the most musical guy in the room, you know, so they're either sampling or coming up with beats or riffs that they've gotten from Fleiss or something like that. But, you know, it feels like a jam session because you're hearing all of the drums going all over everywhere and, you know, bass lines being coming up with. But at some point, the jamming stops because somebody feels like a sweet spot has been hit and we need to use that as a foundation to build upon. Mm-hmm. So they may say, what is that all of a sudden? Man, that kick drum is, let's stay right there. And he'll play a certain pulse with that kick. And then here comes the snare and the 808s and the hi-hats. And then it's like, man, we need a bass line to go with this. And then now let's stack that with some melodies on the keys or, you know, this kind of riff and this guitar thing. So that it really it feels like a jam, but until some sense is made and organization is made out of it. I think holistically, that's what a lot of what happens when you've got creatives in a room is there's a lot of ideas floating and being thrown out in the atmosphere. And it looks very chaotic until something hits. It's say if it was a color spectrum, and all of a sudden I'm looking at all these colors, and it's a particular red. This green or red pops out, and it's like, hold up, everybody notices it. Let's take this, and now that's our foundation, and let's build upon that. You know, so that's kind of how it looks.
Do you teach any kind of workshops or? Do you have any kind of program set up where you, you know, share the knowledge and the wealth of what you've come to know and understand in the industry?
Well, to be honest with you, I haven't done that. I do a lot of one-on-ones, you know, with individuals that I meet. You know, I have a young guy that I'm mentoring now. He's actually studying at Berklee College of Music, and he's 20 years old, but he's from a little small town in Kentucky. And he just came my way. You know, it was one of those things where he emailed me. And so we worked one-on-one, but I have been considering with juggling of my schedule, because I have to be completely honest, I'm terribly busy with being an executive of a label, a music director at a ministry and traveling, that has been the reasoning in which I haven't taken the time to kind of fine tune some things. Marcus Anderson that I mentioned to you earlier, and we were just together in LA last week, and he's just recently taken a job at our alma mater. And so he's handling the musical aspects there at the university. We just had a conversation about me coming in as a guest resident and doing a workshop, just as what you're talking about.
Sure.
Yeah. And well, so we'd love to do that.
Because I'd love to come and sit in on it.
Yeah, same here.
Awesome.
Can you tell us a little bit about your role at Red Worship?
Yeah. So my role, I've been in this position now for about 8 months, and I'm the vice president of the label. So Red Worship is two things. It's Red Worship LLC is the label, which is the umbrella of the actual artist, which Red Worship is an artist. It's a group of collective writers in which I was just speaking about, and performers, singers, musicians, and writers that come together and write songs and birth it. And at this point, we have we released an EP that came out February 24th, and then we followed back a month later on March 24th with another single. And in April this year, we just recorded 10 new songs live over the course of 2 days.
Nice.
A live concert series. And so, I wear a lot of roles with Red Worship. So from the artist perspective of it, I am a writer with them. I am the producer with them. And I'm also the music director with the actual artistry side of Red Worship, the group, the collective. And then from a label perspective of Red Worship LLC, vice president. So day-to-day operational things, high-level conversations, you know, handling DSP pitching, forging relationships with other labels from distribution standpoint, you know, radio promotion, all of those things, PR firms, those conversations, they all come and sift through me.
Gotcha.
Do you enjoy the office work, or do you prefer to be behind the keys?
These days, I actually enjoy the executive aspect of it. Yeah, mm-hmm. More than I was just having that conversation with a guy on Saturday in San Jose, and I said, I'm at a season where the creative side, which will always be there, I get more joy off of pouring knowledge, and it's amazing that you even mentioned that.
Sure.
Pouring my knowledge over the years into the young guns who that's the primary lane in which they're running in now. So I do like the lane, but because now it may be an 8-lane highway and not just a single lane, it's one
Say
of
it.
Which I'm and it's dangerous to be in that position. Honestly, I've dealt with that with a lot of guys that I started in the single lane, and they didn't understand the diversification, multi-streaming,
yes,
whatever you call it, you know, it to be. You know, you will get burnt out at anything that you just do in one way of doing it, at least, if you,
right,
you don't learn to advance yourself within it. To answer your question, I love, from what I really enjoy from a creative standpoint, is to take something that's already being done and reposition it, you know, and put an edge on it. Where a person that may be in that lane can't see any bigger than that, or can't see that the destination can go further than the stoplight ahead of you.
Right.
You know, and so that's the season I am. That from a creative aspect, so in other words, behind the keys would be if I'm listening to a guy play and he's already composing something or already jamming, and I may say, hey, let me hear that, and I might jump in at what he's doing and even learn from him. And then I'd say, hey, this is the approach that we took to this. And if you add this to your vocabulary musically, this would take you in another direction.
Even further. Then, sure, sure.
Yeah, even further. Yeah. And so that's what I do enjoy about it at this season. And then how it complements each other is the fact that I have moved into this executive realm. So my insight is different. The way that I approach sitting down and playing is now for a finished product, you know, is because what I know that the average listener would want to listen to, what would be fashionable in a way that would attract people to want to listen. So jam sessions aren't, it's funny that you speak to that, because jam sessions is what feeds us as creatives and musicians, but doesn't necessarily feed the average listener that will be the consumer. You know, you
right.
have to learn how to dial back and give them simplicity.
Well, you've kind of taken that big picture role, and almost because of your knowledge and because of the people that you speak to on a day-to-day basis, you're kind of that forward-thinking guy too. So what somebody might be working on now, you know, let's take a look at it from this angle, because this will take you here, here, and there.
Sure enough.
Absolutely, man. And I think that just comes with wisdom. Once again, I had no blueprint, even as a behind the keys guys, there wasn't anybody in my family that understood music. You know, in fact, you know, growing up playing in church, I think I'd peaked. I'd pretty much peaked my ability to play at my father's church at about 13 years old. You know, the guys that I looked up to that I told you when I was a kid sitting beside my mom and listening to them play, and these guys come out the nightclub, you know, by me studying them every day at home with this yard sale keyboard that eventually my parents invested in better things for me to play on. But, you know, and I ended up playing at church and started with the youth choir. You know, normally in church, youth choir is the lowest of the tier of choirs that and musical.
sure, but sometimes they're the best later on, right?
Yeah, and so that's what happened. So, you know, by I think probably maybe 10 or 11, you know, the guy that I looked up to asked me to join their choir, which was the premier choir at his church, Fourth Sunday Choir called the Inspirations. He asked me to become the second keys player for them in conjunction with playing for the youth. And so I'm with the adults. You know, this is the choir that packs the church out, standing room only every fourth Sunday. And it got to the point that because I studied in detail, my ear had gotten really sharp and my skill set had matched what I could hear to be able to articulate that on keyboard, that I noticed they weren't learning the songs to the level in which I was studying and playing. And it became problematic. It's a very unique space to be in because at my age, I had to be respectful of my elders. You know, it's like, sure. am I disrespectful by saying this?
This know-it-all kid, I know, yeah.
Right, but the gifting was so, like, there was such a pull on being a perfectionist and continuing to sharpen his craft in me that it would vex me not to say anything. And so I approached my dad about it. And I said, Dad, I don't really want to play with these guys anymore. They're not really professional adult. And then he was offended by that because he didn't understand music. And his response to me was, as long as I'm providing a meal on your table and a roof over your head, you're going to play at my church.
Right.
And I was torn because once again, I'm respecting my elders. I wasn't that kid at all. Sure. I was very respectful. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. You know, never wasn't a problem child at all. But I was torn. And so my older siblings, I told you the difference in age. I said, I asked my brother who lived about 35 minutes away in a neighboring city. I said, man, would you mind if I moved in with you? And I told him what my challenge was. Well, because he was older and I think at probably was in college at that point, was like, I get it, I understand it. You know, being a PK and a limited perspective in which they view things in, it was like, I'm going to help you with this. Sure, you can move in. So while my dad was ministering in church, you know, because by the time the pastors get up to preach, you know, that's most of the musical attributes are done until my dad's a Baptist preacher. He tunes up, what we call it, and starts hooping. Then it's time for you to play. So, and that's where the organ comes in. And so I actually drafted, I was smart enough to have written him a letter, a handwritten letter, telling him I was resigning from his church and that I was moving out of the home, and left it on his pastor's desk, on his desk, while he was ministering.
Best way to do it, right?
And went back in and played for him. So, needless to say, he didn't see the letter until he finished preaching and went back in his office to change clothes and was like, what is this? And I got a ride with him in the car home. So,
I thought you were going to boot out and hide.
No, man. You know, I was waiting for him to respond. So I just didn't have the courage to tell him this, you know, face to face. And so in tears, he said to me as we got home, he says, if it means that much to you, I release you. You can still stay here, but you're free to play for whoever you want to.
Wow.
I didn't know the uniqueness of this because in studying a lot of preachers' kids and their relationship they have, the ones that are musical, with their dads and moms, whoever it may be, a lot of them get stuck in that environment and they're not released. Mm-hmm. And it's like, hey, it's a very tricky thing, you know? And so it hurt my dad at that age, but it led to me to be able to have a life and I'm from North Carolina, a little town that only has 20,000 in population. And now wow. I've traveled the entire world as a result of that. Mm-hmm. My dad's maturity at that age to say that,
but it hurt,
And so he released me, and they've been good. And the guy that I'm referring to, that was the guy that I learned from at those ages and peaked, is still at my dad's church, and he's like 70 years old now. The same guy that plays there.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess I can understand if you're in a place where there's no growth, no new challenges, almost a little boredom. And the fact that you don't want to get stuck in a rut, I mean, you need to move on. You've got no choice, especially if you're a creative and you really have got lots of ideas and things you want to do. It's almost limiting to stay in that place, isn't it?
Absolutely. It really is, man. It wasn't a town that fostered much. It was a great foundation, though.
Sure.
I think that my discipline came as a result of not having a lot of options. This was at the time in that town. It's really not like that now. It's high crime rate, and not much for kids to do. You know, even from a playground perspective, back then it was at least you go outside and run football or basketball or do something musical like I elected to do. And but I think because we didn't have a lot of options, you know, this little town produced great musicians and athletes as a result of that. But we didn't have crime at the time. So if you're familiar with like Maceo Parker, that was James Brown's front man, sax player for years. He lives around the corner from my parents right now to this day.
Wow. Okay.
But then you flip on the athletic side and you can take anywhere from Jerry Stackhouse to Brandon Ingram, that's with the Pelicans now. A lot of basketball players that come from this little town, Kinston, North Carolina, is where I'm from. And so, you know, I think that plays into it. But there again, most of which the guys that are successful to the point of what you're making have to leave because there's a cap in which that ground can foster what your next is, what your next season is.
Yes.
And so some of which I'm wanting to go back to your point again and to create some programs to help cultivate the kids from a musical standpoint that are in that community that need a way out. You know, I think at this point I'm able to create some ways out. So not only help cultivate it, but to give them that next, you know.
Mm-hmm. You described yourself earlier as a perfectionist. Are you still a perfectionist?
Yes, I am. And what I learned, you know,
because that can be good and bad, you know.
And that's a blessing and a curse. You know, it translates to interpersonal relationships and everything else. And you know, I wasn't big on astrology, and not really saying that I am now. But obviously, I live in Los Angeles, so you know, my mind has expanded tremendously past the Bible Belt, where everything is just religious and spiritual. And to the point now that realizing I'm a Virgo and didn't know what that meant, but Virgo is one of the attributes of it is that they are perfectionists. One of the ones I'm proud to be a part of the Virgo family would be Beyonce. And if you know anything about her, she is a perfectionist. You know? So, yeah, that's one of our attributes. I didn't know where it came from. But it's in interpersonal relationships. You know, my wife she knows that about me. And so, you know, she'll say, is this cool to wear today? Do you like my hair? Do you this and that? You know, you try to manage to what degree of perfectionism that it translates, because it can read to be very critical, you know. I do like to strive for perfection. My motto is this. My motto is that, especially from a Christian perspective, in which I am, it's like we're striving to be like God, and He's the only perfect thing that was created.
Yes,
so I think that, you know, the enemy of greatness is being good. And I said, so, you know, we're always striving for perfection, you know, and I'm good is the floor, but great is what we're leaning for. And that pendulum always moves. So small celebrations. If tonight was a great night, it's great as the night ended, you know, and it's time for us to focus on what's the next thing to do. You know, so I'm immediately going into debriefing, and I'll take a moment to celebrate what it is that we did great and reward ourselves for that. But then I'm leaning into what can we do.
Like, what's the next thing? What can we do better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tend to be a perfectionist a lot of times as well. And for me, I don't, I guess I've kind of grown to the point where versus striving for perfection, I strive for excellence because it'll never be perfect. Like I can always go back and think, oh, it could have been better. It could have been better. And then I'm kicking myself for doing that. Right. Versus striving for excellence. That's the best we did as a group or individually with what we had. And yes, we could have done it better, and that's what we'll do next time. But otherwise you can't move on. Right.
Absolutely. And I think to a degree, excellence is perfection because it's doing it the best you can on the level that you're on. And I think that's the qualifying factor for what's next. You know, in my mentorship that I do one-on-one, you know, I'm talking that same language. Like this particular young man that I'm working with, when I met him, we actually purchased him a car, which was an old car from a bass player in a group that I work with. And it had high mileage on it, but this young man was taking public transportation to get to rehearsals and to be mentored. So any vehicle would be better than nothing. And so what I told him, I says, hey, man, value this car. I said, make sure this car is never dirty on the inside, that it's full of gas, there's no service engine lights on, and that you keep it clean and washed. And that's what he's done. And so fast forward a year later, he was able to buy a 2024 brand new car. You know, he's got more employment now. He's doing really well. This is a college student. And I watched him. And he took me to the airport yesterday because I commute from, I fly from San Jose to Los Angeles on a weekly basis. Because my office is there. And so he drives me and he stopped at a light and he got out and he says, man, a bug hit my windshield. And he gets out and he wipes the windshield.
Oh, wow.
You know, but it's a level of gratitude, but he handled excellence on the level that he's on, you know, and it qualified him for what's next. And so even the exchange of that, you know, you think about that, the exchange for what's next means that the vantage point of what you left and where you're at, they're looking at it from a perfectionist standpoint. So the next level for me, I'm looking at them and my viewpoint is, man, you're a perfectionist. But the moment I step out where I'm at, that I'm doing it on excellence because they're viewing me on that level and they give me the hand up because of what they're seeing me doing, is where I get to step on the next level. And then my viewpoint from another level from an individual may be of a perfectionist. So yeah, because it's only one perfect person, which is God, we're never going to hit there. But excellence is definitely will feel like perfection.
And always striving to raise the ceiling too, as far as that excellence is concerned.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even to that point, you talked about the young man. I just think about the fact that faithfulness, man, it goes a long way. We have four little boys and we always tell them, listen, you want better, you take care of what you have now. You do well with it. You be diligent in it and God will bless you with more or with better, you know. But faithfulness, good gracious. Lessons learned.
Yeah. You know, growing up, always watching my dad wash cars, keep them clean, keeping yards looking really well, you know, cutting grass and hedges. And that was a thing that we did all the time. And maintenance on everything, I guess, would be the things that translates to what I've been fortunate to do in the entertainment space.
Right. It's wonderful.
I think that's important to note, too, that the maintenance and taking care of something that's been given to you to maintain or given, you know, the responsibility given to you to do and doing that with excellence because that just accelerates the next project, the next thing that you'll be given to take responsibility for.
Sure enough.
Absolutely. You know, and I don't like to, well, because I don't know the platform of this, but, you know, I'm a man of faith. So often just things start firing at me when you say that, you know, it's like, David in the Bible, man, you know, David was just plowing in the field, you know, that's what he was doing and was fine and diligent at doing so. And just got, he continued to be exalted, you know, to becoming a king, you know. And I think that the qualifying factor is why the lights and the cameras and the action is not on you in a focal point. It's like you being true to your wilderness experience of just you. One-on-one, because how big God is, he sees and knows everything. And often he uses individuals in which peer-to-peer you would think are unqualified. That's all through the Bible that he used people that we would think are unqualified. Back to David, who would think David could have defeated Goliath, a giant? You know, it's just like in stature alone, that's not doable. I mean, if we were betting people, we would all lost our money because we'd have put it on Goliath, like single-handedly, you know. But
yeah, well, who would have thought he'd be a king? I mean, go figure, right?
Yeah, exactly. He didn't even think it. You know, that's the other lesson behind it is that sometimes things are revealed to you in life that you don't even know that's there. You know, Some of the things that I'm doing, you know, I can't say that I would know that I'm having this conversation with you guys. I'm running in an executive lane. I'm living in Los Angeles, California. I didn't see all of that being in a town of 20,000 in Eastern North Carolina. I did know that I was designed to do something much bigger than that landscape, you know. And every time, you know, from leaving that little town to going to the capital of that state, you know, to study Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, that was like a New York City to me, you know, to go and see that much diverse people. And then from moving from there to Atlanta, Georgia, that was a place I never visited, and living there and thinking, this is it, man. And then now I'm here in Los Angeles, California, and it's just, and have traveled the world, you know, and at this point of my life. So, but I think that the commonality is what you're saying, doing the best that you can, level of excellence. Sure. You know, and why nobody is pulling on you to do it. It has to be some self-motivation that's inside of that's the qualifying factor, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's God, the stuff that God has invested in you. And at the end of the day, he's for a return on his investment. And while we're plowing away and being faithful at it and doing what he's put in us to do, time is coming, man, where it's a matter of everything that we've been doing in these past seasons, it's coming to the forefront.
And right.
I think part of it too, Aisha, is not getting too comfortable in what you're doing, because there could be some bigger stuff ahead, and this is just one of the stepping stones to get there.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's why, like, and I'm at the age now where people are asking, what is it? What is it that you want to do? What is it that you see yourself doing the rest of your life? And that's a hard, kind of question to answer, because, I do say holistically, it's about seasons. I do think that what I've learned at my age is that the more I pour into others of what my life, and that for me right now is one-on-one, you know, that when I'm pouring that into others, it's allowing God to open up what the next season for me is, you know? Yes. And so that, and he reveals that the more I pour. And I think that's what we're all here to do, just be vessels and terminals used in which he can communicate what he wants to see happen through us being the terminals to give that to the next person. You know, I hate to keep referring to this young man, but this particular guy is one of the closest things to me, because when I met him, I didn't realize his upbringing or anything of that nature. Well, he lost his dad, his biological father, at 16. And here recently, the last 3 months, his mom passed suddenly. We were actually working on a new single, because he interned me, and we were preparing to shoot a video and record a new single the next day, which was on a Wednesday. And we were in the studio that Tuesday doing pre-production. And I noticed he had been gone for about 2 hours. He had been there with me all day, and this is about 11 at night. And so I asked one of the guys, I said, where's Robbie at? Have you guys seen Robbie? I needed him to run some errands for me. And they said, no, we haven't seen him. And by that time, he had come back in there. He had his phone, and he was in tears. He had gotten a call that his mom had had a massive heart attack and passed.
Jesus.
Yeah, and so I'm saying that to say you never know why God connects you with individuals and what it looks like, you know. And I'm the closest thing he has to a parent at this point, you know. And so if I was selfish and just say, let me just keep all of what God has done for me, and, you know, to myself, not share with others, you know, he needs this. He's got three younger siblings who don't have a biological mother or father at this point that he's got to raise at 20, you know. And so it's like, you know, you just don't really know what it is that I couldn't imagine 2 years ago, which is when I met him, that he would have come into my life and that this would be the outcome of what it is at this short amount of time. So where I'm at is like very crystal clear on the fact that I'm here as a terminal to help feed and to pour into other people's lives and to mentor. And mm-hmm. I get a joy from doing so. But it requires you to release things.
You know, right.
You have to release things. But as a result of releasing that, it's like you're packing more foundation and dirt underneath your feet to be elevated to what your next season is.
And part of that is just recognizing when it's time to take a step back and elevate someone else and mentor them and pour into them, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely. Yeah, because you never know. I mean, in the marketplace, anywhere you go, you really are not privy to knowing who needs what it is that you have. So where I used to, by default, I'm an introvert, believe it or not. I'm sure you guys couldn't gather that by this conversation, but I'm really an introvert, you know, and but there's a root to that, you know what I mean? That it's normally based in fear or trauma at some point, you know what I mean? I don't really, and so I've kind of gravitated away from saying that, you know, but that is my default, you know. There is a cap for me. Where, I've poured out so much, I need to kind of just go somewhere and isolate. And my wife knows that really well. So because she's a social bubble and we're always attending events here, she has a large circle of friends and most of our environment, they're always wanting to get free mental health. So what do you think about this? What's going on with me? They're telling all their business and I'm there to support her and I'm piggybacking off of it a lot of times because she wants me to at least get a honorary doctorate because I know all of her methods at this point.
Because you've heard it, right? Yeah, exactly.
But what often happens is when we leave an event and we're in that car riding home, she's like, I know you're depleted at this point. And I'm quiet in the car. And she knows like, he's back in introvert mode. And I'm ready to go home and go to sleep at that point. So yeah, but no, I do enjoy sharing. I really do. It's a great thing to do.
The introvert extrovert issue there. I think for an introvert, it's you can do the outward stuff, but it's exhausting. And so when you get in the car, it's like you're worn out. You need to, take that step and just, you know what? Doing nothing now. Just don't bother me.
Yeah.
Right.
Don't call me. Don't email me. I'm out of it for a bit.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
When is your birthday, Terrence?
It's August 27th.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. I ask because you mentioned being a Virgo, and my husband is a Virgo also, and I almost can't wait for him to hear this episode because you all are so much alike. It's hilarious.
Wow.
Just the visionary and the heart to serve and the heart to give everything that's been given to you, the knowledge. And like we were in a meeting just last week with a potential client and the young man that we may be doing some work with, he was like, I'm gonna have to call you a smooth criminal. Cause my husband is like, he doesn't have a whole lot to say, but when he says something, you should be taking notes. And so I feel like this conversation has been just weighty. It's been very encouraging and I thank God for what he's doing in your ministry and in your businesses. And man, it makes me excited because we are working on some things, and just having a conversation lets us know that we're not lone rangers in this thing, you know? So thank you for
that. That's awesome. Man, that's awesome to hear you say that. And I believe in the divine timing. This conversation probably would not have looked the way that it is looking today if it had happened any other time than right now.
Right.
And that's you know, it's the, you know, it says, be still and know that I am God. And because he operates on a different timing than what we operate on, and he's the only perfect person that he uses, and he using all of us to do this, you know? And so that's, right. So if it's anything that I shared that resonates you, of course, you know, it's no way that I would know that. And so it's the divine that's using me and you guys. I'm learning a lot, you know, and things are being affirmed as I'm hearing you guys communicate as well. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity to get to know you guys and to share with you.
Well, listen, thank you so much, Terrence, for joining us on Between the Grooves. I appreciate
thank
your
you.
Time,
thank
Terrence.
You, anytime. We'd love to come back and interview at a later date, too.
Awesome. Sounds great.
All right. You guys have a blessed week.
You too, Terrence. Take
you
care.
Too.
All right. Take
Thanks
care.
Again.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Wow. I'm exhausted. We covered so much in that conversation.
We really did.
I mean,
wisdom too.
Such wisdom. And that guy has so much knowledge, everything to do with whether it's jazz music or hip hop or co-writing, mentoring. He's just done so much. And he has that vision for, you know, training up leaders and training up people, you know, to take the reins, as it were. And and I really admire that as well. And I was really, I've said this many times, but I was not expecting that conversation. So I really enjoyed that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did too. Very much so. A lot to take away and a lot to kind of keep in your heart and ponder.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to actually chatting again sometime. I'd love to get with him and pick his brain about some other things.
I hear you.
Well, right here, we're going to listen to some artist advice from Mr. Aaron Rice.
Be authentic. In particular, the Christian market values authenticity more than anything, more than talent, more than the song you sing. They want to, it's not just the Christian market. Our fans in general, they want to feel like they know you.
Yes.
So be authentic. And I don't mean that just in sing what you believe or believe what you sing. I mean that in be entirely you to the best of your ability.
Yeah.
Be real with your struggles, your mess ups, your successes. It's okay to be proud when something goes well in a healthy manner. It's okay to feel good about yourself while pointing glory to God. But be authentic. That is number one, authenticity.
Yeah.
And then write great music.
Just makes my heart smile.
Why? Why?
Because I've written with Aaron. My very first project that was released on Goatee Records, we wrote some songs together. Oh, I take that back. My second project with Goatee, we wrote together, and just to see his journey, you know, and hear his heart and the advice that he gave, be authentic, to see authenticity played out in his own life. And it just makes my heart smile. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that advice.
I think for artists to be artificial and fake, I think fans and listeners can see past that.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know? And you have to think to yourself, I mean, obviously as a Christian artist, you want to glorify God, but at the end of the day, these fans are listening to your music for a reason. And if you're not being relatable to them, then why should they follow you? Why should they listen to your stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's for any genre of music, but particularly in the Christian side of things. And that's the reason why if you fall big time, it's so devastating for singers or listeners and fans of your music as well, right?
Right. Yeah, it's very true. And it can be on either side of the spectrum, because in some senses or in some points, people are very understanding and forgiving. And then on the other end of the spectrum, people can be very harsh and cruel.
Yeah.
And unforgiving.
Right.
So I think when you are authentic, if you do happen to fall, people are more forgiving if they can relate.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If they know that you've been authentic and
because they've been with you on that journey. They've been with you on that journey. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Versus something you just kind of find out about in the blue, and it's just like, what?
Right.
He did that? It's like, really?
Exactly.
Like, no clue that he had this hidden life, you know?
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. Good words of wisdom once again from Aaron Rice. And thank you to our guest, Terrence, for joining us on Between the Grooves this week. And thank you to you for listening and for hanging out with us.
Thanks for listening to Faith Strong Today's Between the Grooves podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, would you consider sharing it with your friends, rating our podcast, or giving us some love on your socials to your amazing friends and followers will only help us reach more people. We'd also love to hear from you and share your feedback in an upcoming episode. Send your video or written message to Aisha and James on Facebook and Twitter at Between Grooves, or email us anytime, hello@faithstrongtoday.com.